Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Chicago Business Podcast, where we introduce leading executives in the area and learn how innovation is changing their industries. I am your host, Drew Sekula, and today we welcome Gershi Van, founder and CEO of Magna Capital Funds, a quantitative hedge fund started in 2020. Hello, Gershi. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Drew.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Happy to have you on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Very good. Well, before we get into it, I always like to break the ice with the beverage of the day. So why don't you tell us about your selection this morning?
Sure. So I got the Grande Ice Shake and Espresso. I think it's the, you get your caffeine in, but it's not, doesn't hit you too hard. It's a summer type drink. I enjoy it.
Very nice.
Yeah, yours, Drew?
I got one right here. Yes. Excellent. Matching you for it. So cheers to that.
Cheers. Yeah. Drew, what was the origin for the drink break the ice type thing?
You know, it was just something I was, when I was coming up with the concept of the show, I wanted to do something a little bit different and, you know, seemed like something fun to do. So BOD, board of directors, you know, beverage of the day. Why not?
I love it. I think it's great. It's like an easy bonding point, but you know, I think it's awesome. Yeah. Well done.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah. And I'm a creamless guy. I don't really like cream in my drinks. So, you know, I had to make sure they got that one right. But
there's a purity there. I think that's great. I have to go with the cream because the acid's too much and all of that. So I stick with the cream.
No worries. Well, okay, why don't you give us an overview, kind of what you guys have going on there at Magna Capital Funds?
Sure. So we're a quantitative hedge fund focused on, you know, utilizing volatility as a paradigm, as a pair of glasses to kind of look into the market. And so what we do is we divide the market down into three different volatility states. You can think of those as like, you know, how much movement is going on in the market in each day. And then we think of those as like, market states that are structurally different. And then we design portfolios for each of those market states. And then we utilize machine learning to select the optimal portfolio for each trading day.
Wow. So there's a lot there. Sounds quite interesting. I'm excited to delve into it here on the podcast today. So maybe let's take a step back and hear a little bit about your origin story though. Where'd you grow up and talk about your ties to Chicago?
Sure. So I'm from Southern California originally. I grew up in Calabasas. It was a beautiful city, great place to grow up. Really interesting place to, you know, kind of get to know the world. It was a warm place. My dad is a rabbi out there. So it was interesting being like the oldest son in the synagogue and getting to know everybody who came there. Yeah, so I was in Calabasas until I was about 16. And then I moved out to New York City. I studied Jewish law for about 3 years. And then I went to college, Lander College, got my degree in finance, and then moved out to Chicago. My wife dragged me here.
Nice. Well, it's not such a bad place to be, you know.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, I didn't mean it like that. Yeah. No, the weather is definitely something that's, you know, that's different that you get used to, especially coming from Southern California. But I actually have come to love the Chicago vibe. I think, you know, having lived both in Los Angeles, in New York, and then in Chicago, I find LA to be a little too slow paced for me at this point. New York to be a little bit too quick paced, and Chicago to have like a kind of balanced vibe that I've, grown comfortable with.
Yeah, you have a couple of kids too, isn't that right?
I do. I have two daughters, Kaylee and Liel. They're 2 years old, 1 year, 1 year old. And so that's something also I think about Chicago. Like people leave the office at 5 or 6 p.m. and you go home and you spend time with your family, which I think is so important. I think it changes your connection, your you know, approach to the office. And I love spending time with them. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, especially at those ages, you guys got your hands full, no doubt. Mine are a little bit older. Mine are, my son is 12 and my daughter's almost 10 now, so. It's been fun too here, but yeah, we were just talking before the call a little bit about how it's nice that it seems like the city's opening up a little bit. So I see you're back in the office. Is that right?
Yeah, we've made a big push to, you know, so long as it was feasible and was safe, you know, to spend time in the office. I'm a big believer in the collaboration and the, you know, blossoming of ideas that comes from, you know, really working face to face. There's there's a wholeness of body language that you can capture face to face, and a range of ideas that you can get through that I don't think you can really get through to the same extent via Zoom. So we follow like a 3-2 type structure where, you know, everybody's in the office 3 days out of the week, and then 2 days they can work from home, do their thing. And it's worked pretty well for us. I think we fully came back to the office around February or so. We had a little hiatus where, you know, everybody went home when there was the last spike.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So why don't you tell us a little, you have a pretty sizable team over there. Why don't you tell us kind of what that's comprised of and what that looks like?
Sure. Yeah. I'm a huge believer in team. I think there's this misconception that, you know, that as a startup, you have to be as lean as possible. Now, obviously, you know, you need funding to bring on team, you know, as your payroll expands, your fixed expenses, you know, go up. But I think the nature of a startup is you know, you have your business idea, but then, you know, from bringing it from an idea to actually getting it to market requires you to pivot like hundreds of times. And that requires that your marketing content changes, your product changes a little bit. And, you know, as you go through all of those, having more people who can join in those conversations, who can assist you in making those pivots, just makes it so much easier. So I've tried to bring on different people who, you know, bring different perspectives to the table, who have strengths where I have weaknesses. And that's, you know, enabled us to be much stronger as a team. So the team basically breaks down as, in terms of senior leadership, we have myself as the CEO, and I oversee the algorithmic side, the quantitative side. So trading and, you know, quantitative research, machine learning, that type of thing. Our COO and CMO, Katie Franks, she oversees marketing and then business development. And then our head of culture, people and culture, Brooke Stratman, she, I guess, oversees HR. And then our, am I missing one senior leadership? Yeah, Ryan, sorry. Ryan Hagen, our chief financial officer and chief compliance officer, oversees, you know, finances and compliance and all of that. And then, you know, it goes down from there.
Right. You guys have taken a little different approach than a lot of hedge funds in terms of raise some capital. Why don't you tell us about that?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's really interesting. I think that hedge funds are this optimal tool for a venture capital type approach. It's not very expensive to run a hedge fund. You know, it doesn't cost you $0, but you can get a pretty successful hedge fund off the ground for between $5 and $10 million. But the cost of making that hedge fund sustainable, or the assets under management necessary to make that hedge fund sustainable, you need something like $100 million. So, you know, the typical approach to attracting that capital is to find someone who's going to write you a check for $100 million. Now, you know, if you're an industry insider, that's great. You know, you find someone, you know, the right people who are going to write that $100 million check. And you get that $100 million check. But if you're an outsider, maybe you have some idea that's novel, but you know, didn't go to the exact same places that someone else did, or you don't have 10 or 15 years of industry experience, then I think it's best to follow the venture capital type model where you're raising capital for operating costs. And, you know, you have heavy operating costs, but you can then produce a product that's brilliant and beautiful enough that investors are interested and they start allocating capital to us. And so that's the path that we've followed. And so far it's worked out pretty well.
Nice. So you guys have a couple of funds that you put together so far. Why don't you tell us about each of those?
Sure. So, I mean, my approach has been to, you know, approach launching funds similar to the way that a consumer packaged goods company would approach launching different, you know, consumer packaged goods. So, you know, if you're Procter & Gamble or something, you know, some similar type company, and you want to launch different shampoo lines, you're going to cater your shampoos to specific demographics. And I think because financial products are so abstract and so difficult to connect to, the goal typically is to launch a financial product geared towards the intermediary. So, you know, you have your investor and then you have your your person who stands between that investor and the hedge fund, the allocator. And so you launch something that they understand. But that produces like a lot of disconnection from the end person. And I thought it would be wonderful to launch products that had like an aesthetic to it, that had some guiding philosophy that people could connect to. So to that end, the first product that we launched, our Magma Total Return Fund, was geared more of like a traditional hedge fund, started off high net worth individuals, and now we're graduating into the institutional investor space. And that was kind of focused on, like I said earlier, looking at volatility and then building something that's just allocated to the stock market and the treasury market. So kind of like a 60-40 type portfolio, just optimized for the modern day with machine learning, et cetera. The second product that we launched is called Obsidian. And that's geared towards the professional athlete space. I found the notion of, building a financial product for the professional athlete space that could, really do some good and stabilize a lot of athletes to be like a really intriguing and compelling idea. I think, a lot of athletes, they could come from lower income backgrounds, and they're like the stars of their area. They're what inspires the people from that, from that community to, to expand their ambitions and to think that they can do it. And the idea that there's very few financial products geared towards that community was just very frustrating. So, we launched a product for that space. We're making some inroads. It takes time to, it's somewhat like a family. So it takes time to, gain a trusted reputation and all that. And then the product that we're in the midst of launching right now is called Estes. That's geared towards float capital. So, in a world the way that it is right now, if you put money in your bank account, you earn 0.01%. There's basically no yield at all to be had for money that just sits around. So the goal is to create a financial product that could return something like 5% per year. We would share in the upside and share in the downside. And then, the hope is for a lot of people who are sitting on, lots of money for short periods of time. Maybe that could be a real estate company, or it could be some private equity company, or it could be, you name it, insurance company, anybody who's sitting on some pool of capital that they have for, let's say, 6 months or a year or anything like that. They could park, in this fund, and they could pull it any day. So those are the three products we have so far. And I'm sure there'll be more to come, but for now, that's the focus.
Yeah, well, that's probably plenty to get started with and to get you Definitely. Going. You guys have been going since, when did you start last year?
So I raised my first capital, to fund the operations in February of 2020. I rented my office space in March, and then the whole world shut down. So it's been a hell of a ride.
I'd say, yeah. Why don't you take us through that a little bit. Tell us how COVID-19 impacted getting off the ground.
Sure. So I think it was a little bit of a positive and a negative, or you could say a negative and a positive. It was really, there's an element of uncertainty that comes from, getting off the ground with COVID. You don't know if you're, first of all, will your thesis continue to work? And even if your thesis works, will the world ever return to normal? Will people are writing large checks? Will people ever feel confident enough to, write, let's say $100,000, $250,000 checks to someone who doesn't have experience in the industry? That was definitely like an early concern. And then also it was weird to like work where there's no one there. I mean, everyone went home and the future was so uncertain. But then on the flip side, I had raised $1.5 million at that point. And there were some just absolutely brilliant people from VC-backed startups that don't normally, they don't normally end up unemployed. And they were left unemployed because, a lot of these companies, especially in like the commercial property space, just laid off an enormous amount of their employees. And so I saw this as an opportunity to kind of just go for it and start hiring people and building that dream team to take the product to market. And so in that respect, it was a really positive thing. And one of the nice things too is that when you build around that environment, things don't faze you as much later on. Like the challenges don't seem as acute. So it was good and bad.
Yeah. Well, that's... Yeah, you definitely picked an interesting time to do it. And I guess not by choice, but it sounds like, things have a way of working out, no doubt. So you were able to pick up some good team members there. And you mentioned you don't have a whole lot of experience in the industry. Why don't we talk about your background?
Sure. My undergraduate degree is in finance. I'm passionate about economic systems, and just the notion of, you know, of how you can create a system that money passes through, that incentivizes X, Y, and Z, whatever the system is. People could be completely not cognizant of its existence, and yet exist and move within that system. And that concept has always blown my mind. So that was something that really stuck out to me. This is particularly true of macroeconomics, where you could have, let's say, the Federal Reserve guiding specific policies. Like, for example, let's say they were to cut interest rates. So like the most important person in the US economy right now is Jerome Powell. He's the head of the Federal Reserve. But if you were to ask the average person on the street who Jerome Powell is, I think it's fair to say that most people would not know who he is. And yet he single-handedly pretty much saved the US economy during the COVID meltdown. That's a staggering fact. And that's something that I've always been drawn to, because I don't necessarily need to be the person in the front, but I like to design the systems that kind of orchestrate how things happen. So that was what, you know, really appealed to me when I was getting my undergraduate degree. When I came out to Chicago, I ended up going into business intelligence. I found it difficult to find a finance job that I was really drawn to. So I went into business intelligence, where, you know, I was tasked with designing, similar to this concept, designing systems that would optimize performance in, you know, it could be designing systems for, you know, like the labor pool within a specific company. I worked in the dialysis space for a little bit. So we were optimizing shifts and that type of thing. So that was a lot of fun. And then, you know, we had to build a model to forecast the amount of patients that were going to come into specific regions. And so that helped business development. But my passion was always towards finance. And I started working on a model, this model that I mentioned earlier, you know, focused on volatility at the beginning of 2019. Because I was reading a book by Ray Dalio called Principles. And I remember just going through it. Ray Dalio is like one of the most successful hedge fund founders of all time. When he stepped down, he was from Bridgewater and Associates. His fund was managing close to $160 billion. And I remember reading about the humble origins, and he was like a kid from Brooklyn, and the way he designed his fund. And I remember thinking that, like, this is complicated and it's going to be difficult, but it's not so difficult that it can't be done. And so, you know, that kind of was the genesis for, you know, let me come up with my own idea, and then let me, you know, raise some capital and then start the company.
Nice. You talked about how you guys integrate AI and machine learning. Why don't you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So I think, you know, there's a lot of fear about whether machines will overtake humans. I think there are certain things that humans are very good at. Let's say, like, you know, general knowledge. So responding to situations that are uncommon, humans are very good at. And then there are things that machines are much better at. So for example, a fact that I've always found intriguing is that the reason why in the United States, a typical phone number is seven digits is because humans struggle to memorize anything longer than seven digits. And then not the area code, but just, you know, the main part of the number. So, and then beyond even that, the seven digits is broken up into a three and a four. And even beyond that, we still struggle to memorize those numbers. So the notion that, like, you know, if we're dealing, so let's say, like, if someone's making a decision about trading on any given day, they're going to try to synthesize, you know, hundreds of different streams of information. The idea that they could synthesize that as well as a machine, which could look back on, let's say, the past 20, 30, 40 years, and make a quantifiable decision, the idea that humans could outperform that, I find that to be unlikely. So I think the place for, you know, humans in trading down the line is to drive research ideas, is to know when the model is making a mistake, you know, to understand the limitations of, you know, what the model understands. But, you know, like, I think one area where this revolution has already happened is, if let's say someone said, you know, you asked someone a question and they gave an answer and their answer was contrary to an answer that Google gave, you wouldn't say, well, you know, they're probably right and Google's wrong. You'd probably say, well, Google's probably right, because we recognize that Google is essentially the authority here. I think that's going to happen in trading as well. I think, especially like as it pertains to trading, you know, in a more active fashion, let's say you're trading, you know, once a day or once every 3 days, so that type of thing. I think the notion that humans can continue to outperform with the actual trading, designing the models, is just unlikely.
So talk me through one of those models then that that you guys utilize in your investments.
So there's an element of a black box to it. You know, what you do is you design a model with a specific, you know, aim in mind. So like, let's say you wanted to build a machine learning model to identify birds, right? So you would train it on like an enormous amount of data, and then it would get better and better and better at identifying birds. So in our case, what we're trying to do is we're trying to train a model to select the optimal portfolio for a specific trading day. So, you know, you can think of it as like, we have your risk assets, which are your, you know, your S&P 500, your Dow Jones Industrial Average, and your NASDAQ. And then you have your risk off assets, which is your, you know, your 10-year treasury note and your 30-year treasury note. So call them like intermediate and long-term treasuries. And now the question is, in different volatility states, what's the optimal portfolio allocation? And then once you design that optimal portfolio allocation, how do you decide on a daily basis which one you should select? Is the optimal selection for today a medium volatility type portfolio? Is it a high volatility type portfolio? So you're training machine learning models to, you know, the first thing you do is you look for signals. So, you know, is XYZ input predictive? Can we feed this to a neural network, to a machine learning model? And can it then make a decision that improves our performance? And so, you know, we have a team of, right now we have 3 quantitative researchers and 2 interns, and we'll be expanding the team, you know, over the coming months, that entirely just work on, you know, this, you know, iterative process of like, you know, how do we continue to find better and better predictors and more models so we can, you know, make the best trading decisions on a daily basis and return, you know, relative to risk, produce the highest return for our investors.
Wow, sounds quite fascinating to try to get that all right.
I mean, I love it because it's nice because I get to come to the office and learn all of this stuff. You know, I haven't been trained in machine learning in the past. I see myself more as, you know, the CEO is kind of the quarterback or the, you know, the orchestrator. And it's wonderful to work with so many brilliant people and, you know, see how all of these things work. So it's a joy.
Awesome. What have you found to be the most challenging part of it?
Specifically machine learning?
No, just getting the business off the ground over the last year and some months.
That's a really good question. I think that, you know, managing or keeping everything in balance, you know, ensuring that, let's say, every employee is happy and they're contributing, you know, to the common cause, if you will, ensuring that all the investors are happy, ensuring that all the partners are happy, and ensuring that everyone is comfortable with the direction that you're moving is a tremendous balancing act. And, you know, ensuring that your head doesn't explode and, you know, you continue walking the line and then pivoting when necessary and explaining that pivot to everyone and bringing everyone on board with the new, you know, direction is, has been a unique challenge.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's kind of like a dance, you know, and as you get better, I would assume that everybody who gets good at what they do, it becomes like an art form for them, you know, and as you get better and better at that, it just gets to be a ton of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds good. What, as you look forward, what are your most critical business initiatives?
Sure. So you mean like for the business to be successful?
Yeah. For goals that you have for the business looking ahead.
So we'd love to, you know, really scale up our assets under management. We're at around $5 million right now. You know, we want to get to, I would say, the tens of millions, you know, over the coming months. I don't want to put a specific number on it, but you know, and really driving initiatives in that direction. So we have a few initiatives that we're working on, you know, from either, you know, an acquisitions perspective or, you know, providing some like fixed income type, you know, dollop on top of what someone would receive from a typical investment, and starting to pursue much larger pools of capital. You know, ultimately when you're pursuing individuals, even if someone is extraordinarily wealthy, let's say they have a net worth of $15 or $20 million, writing a $1 million check for that person is still, you know, quite a substantial commitment. You know, when you talk about institutional investors who are managing, let's say, anywhere from $100 to $500 million, well, now $1 million check is actually quite a small percentage of their portfolio. So really graduating from, you know, that initial stage of where you're pursuing your $2,500,000 checks to pursuing those $1 to $5 million checks, I think is really, really critical for us getting to the next stage.
How do you, how do your fees work then? Is it kind of tip? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's pretty conventional. You know, it's 2 and 20. So 2%, the 2% fee is your management fee. So you space that out essentially over a year. And so if you take 2%, you divide it by 12, you have 0.167% or 16.7 basis points. And that's the charge on the balance every single month. And that's just designed, that goes to a specific management company entity, and that's designed to cover your operating costs. Now, initially, obviously, it doesn't come close to covering your operating costs, because if you think about like the typical economics, so let's say you have a $100 million fund and you're taking, you know, 2% a year in management fees. So now you have $2 million of revenue, you can afford to run an operation. Now, obviously, if you're where I am, where you have, let's say $5 million, you're taking in roughly $100,000 a year, but you're still running the same operation that you would be running at $100 million. So you're running a deficit until you get to that point. And then the 20% is just 20% of performance. So like, for example, let's suppose we were to produce, let's say we're managing $1 million, we were to produce a 20% return. So $200,000 for the investor, we would keep 20% of that 200,000 or $40,000. And that would go to a separate entity called the general partnership, which has like its own, you know, group of owners, et cetera.
Right. Yeah. So typical setup in terms of the hedge fund fees is just, you know, getting that up and going is the challenging part. What, you have a lot on your plate, man, between getting that business going and the two little ones. Do you, you have time to be involved in any other interests out in the community?
I try, you know, I'm a member of synagogue in Lincolnwood. So I very much enjoy the time that I spend there. I recently did a charitable drive with an organization that supports kids with cancer. It's called Chi Lifeline. It was really, really nice to, they had to raise, I think, $600,000 or $700,000 to plug a budget hole. And it was really nice to be able to be a part of that and, you know, raise some money for them. Other than that, I'd say, you know, mostly just reading and some TV shows and just trying to stay on top of the different responsibilities that I have between, you know, being a husband, being a manager, being a father, being a sibling, et cetera.
Yeah.
I do my best, but not always up to snuff.
Yeah, I think we all look inside and know we could do a little bit better if we just squeezed out a little more, but the nature of being a human, I think. So, all right. Well, for people who want to learn more about you guys, where can they find you?
So we have a website, magmacapitalfunds.com. I would say that's the easiest way. We also have a LinkedIn page. So I guess you just look up Magma Capital Funds on LinkedIn. And then in terms of the athlete page, I know we have some presence on Instagram. Yeah, I think that's most of our presence.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I'll include links to everything in the description, and we can, you know, hopefully drive some traffic your way. So
thank you.
Yeah. Well, very nice to have you on. Thank you for your time today, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Absolutely. Likewise. It was a pleasure.
Yep. Cheers.